Hello everyone, and welcome to today's segment of the Indian Conflict Resolution podcast series. This series is brought to you by the online Indian Journal of Peace and Conflict Resolution, and I am Tejasvi Shukla, your host for the day. In today's episode, we shall be discussing a very significant challenge facing contemporary geopolitical stability and security: post-conflict peace building, migration, refugee crisis, and rehabilitation. We have with us today a seasoned expert in the domain, Dr. Parivalan KM. Dr. Parivalan is currently serving as Associate Professor at the Center for Statelessness and Refugee Studies at the School of Law, Rights and Constitutional Governance, Agra Institute of Social Sciences, Mumbai. An alumnus of Jawaharlal Nehru University, he had previously worked at the UNDP, facilitated the post-tsunami recovery process, and at the UNHCR as a repatriation specialist, facilitated the voluntary repatriation of Sri Lankan Tamil refugees during the peace process. He has been invited as a visiting faculty to the European Masters in Migration and Intercultural Studies intensive phase program at the Oldenburg University, Germany, which is where I believe he's joining us from today. Thank you so much for joining us today, sir, and we are very grateful to have you today, Dr. Parivalan.
Pleasure joining you, Ms. Tejasvi.
Thank you so much, sir. Before we delve in directly into talking of the nuances that concern the subject at hand today, it would be really helpful to our listeners, sir, if you could define briefly what exactly do we understand by migration and how can we categorize various kinds of migrants, especially in the South Asian context?
Well, as we all are aware, migration is a part and parcel of human evolution, human endeavor. It has been always recorded that humans have migrated. But what is very important at this juncture is to categorize the voluntary migration versus the forced migration. I think that's something very important. When voluntary migration happens, obviously, as we all know, is for economic reasons, for the better, greener pastures, people decide to move. There's no issue about it. There are fairly good regulations and facilitations which happens around the world. But where the problem lies is in the category of forced migration. When somebody is involuntarily displaced, it becomes very problematic. It can emanate at the outset from three broader areas: A, due to conflicts or human rights violations. B, it could be caused by development and other endeavors. And C, it could be climate and disaster-induced displacement. Now, the forced migration is something that we need to really look at. How do we address this issue? Because this is really an unprecedented situation we are right now. The kind of conflicts and events which are taking place all around us, starting with in the recent times with Syria to Ukraine-Russia war to Sudan and many other instabilities, have contributed nearly to about 105 million people forcefully displaced. That's something unprecedented in the recent human migration history, where forced migration numbers are recorded around 105 million. This is just the official statistics available. It could be much, much more. This is something very worrisome. How do we look at the forced migration? Yes.
Right, sir. Right. So that actually makes us think that because these forced migrations have increased in numerical terms, that do only officially, how do you think have these migrations actually changed? What has been the factor that has just jumbled up, doubled and tripled these numbers in the last, say, 3 to 4 decades, especially if we talk about the South Asian region?
Yes, absolutely. See, in my own observation, last 2 decades, I've been working with the refugees and other issues. In my own experience in 2003-05, when I was with UNHCR, these numbers were somewhere ranging around 25 to 30 million. Okay. Imagine in these 2 decades, from 25, 30 million, it has come to 105 million. This is drastically 3 or 4-fold increase. Okay. Is something very worrisome. So what is the reason behind it? I think it is the increase in conflict, the scale and intensity of conflict, which is, I think, displacing a lot of people. Either it could be internal displacement, of course, or it could be in the form of external displacement. We call it as refugees migrants, asylum seekers outside. So anyway, this is a pattern because of the scale and intensity of conflicts have increased. Therefore, I think in the last one decade, at least, we can see a substantial increase. Coming to our own region also, we have had migrations, forced migrations, colonial, post-colonial, and so on and so forth. Right away, we can just take the example of partition. It alone triggered around 13 to 14 million people across India and the newly born East-West Pakistan, as we all know in the history. It's something very important for us to record that 14 million people being crisscrossed and displaced is a huge, huge management when you are trying to have a country, new countries being resettled. As a part of the two-nation theory whatsoever. Now then, that didn't stop there. You know, subsequently in 1971, we have had again the East Pakistan becoming Bangladesh. During the process, again, nearly about 10 million people got displaced. India did host most of them as refugees here and was very graceful enough to handle it without any external support. And rather with a lot of external coercion, we can say, as a point of the Cold War scenario which prevailed at that time. So therefore, this has been there in our situation. And then we have had migrants coming from Tibet region when Chinese occupied it. We have had situations of Sri Lankan ethnic conflict triggering several lakh refugees at different points of time from 1983 to almost to till recently. Now, the most important is about the Myanmar, even though it's a little outside South Asian region, but bordering us in Southeast Asia. The Myanmar conflict and restlessness is triggering a lot of people, not just Rohingyas, which are very visibly there. My recent visit to Northeast region, Mizoram and all that, I could understand that there are Ching refugees, Kukis, who flow into India and they are not formally recognized and they do have a huge number of issues which is grappling there, and it's very geopolitical and it's after all very important corridor for us to manage. So now you have an unregulated flow of people coming in, and if there is no formal recognition, formal accounting on both sides, it becomes a problem for the Indian state to understand who has come in, who has gone out. If this not accounted, it's a problem, as well as the people who come in, if they're not recognized, they also suffer because they cannot avail their livelihoods or other basic necessities. So both way, this is an issue we need to address. Yes.
That is so true, sir. I'm so happy that you mentioned even about the Chin refugees, because I believe in western part of Delhi, there are a lot of them and not living in very good conditions and not even recognized. Taking from there, sir, because you've had personal experiences as a peacemaker and a peace builder, what do you draw as the major challenges that peace builders and makers particularly face both at the policy and operational level in this region? You draw it from your experiences.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's very important for me to record the importance of having legislations and legal frameworks. That at the outset, I feel is very, very problematic in South Asia, because South Asian countries, excepting for technical reasons, Afghanistan, they have almost none of the countries the signatories to the international law pertaining to migration or forced migration. For example, you have 1951 Convention, 1967 Protocol, you have the Statelessness Convention 1954, Statelessness Reduction 1961, and so on and so forth. You have a number of them. Important migratory laws are not, international laws are not signed or ratified. That becomes one vacuum or a problem at the outset. The second is, if not signing those legislations, those international frameworks, at least I think we should have our own national legislations, that we have not done it. And this enormously contributes to mobility problems. And this enormously makes, if I may quote the Calcutta Research Group, which I'm part of also, it gives an important interpretation of migration here, that it is massive and mixed flow of people. Unlike in Europe and other places, you have a regulated, monitored, individually status determined people who come in, and they do have a process of doing it. But whereas here, we don't have that. You have in thousands, in lakhs, people pour in. And that's one problem again, the flow of people in or out. The third level is as a peace builder or a peacemaker, when we look at it, when you don't have these kind of legal frameworks, then obviously it becomes very problematic to even work with the group. If you want to go and sit and work with Rohingyas or Chin refugees or Sri Lankans, you have to have your own formal permissions and other channels, which I feel again as a policy level and practice level as an obstacle. But these things do prevail, and I think definitely it is time for us definitely to have a better understanding of humanitarianism needed in the region, better way of students, practitioners who should be groomed in this thing. We have, as of now, very limited external induced actors who may come in. But I think we need to build a lot and lot more people who can have a better understanding of the local nuances, local issues, and they will better play the epistemic justice role when there are lots of epistemic injustices which prevail, because lots of groups are very invisible. That itself is a problem. You have lots of people who are in the margins, in the borderlands, who are very invisible. They struggle, they migrate, they move around, they because of the lack of laws, they all get branded as illegal migrants or infiltrators. That becomes very problematic for peacemakers, peace builders, or humanitarian professionals wanting to deliver good amount of services. Just to cite an example in my own experience of working with Sri Lankan refugees more closely. If two decades back, UNHCR limited mandate and limited access to work with them, only to support their voluntary migration. Now, if you have to go to the camp, look at the conditions, aid them, help them, it was absolutely not permissible at that time. But I think in the last few years, things have changed in the last one decade. And I think now people do have access to the camp, and they do quite a bit of relief rehabilitation work. So in my own journey, if I see now that as a member of an advisory committee, now we have the access to go to the camps, interact with refugees. Earlier, even to go to a particular camp, we need to do a lot of formal procedures to go and access a camp. But now, we can make a phone call or just inform and then proceed. Anyway, how do then other common actors, peace builders or humanitarian professionals, humanitarian workers want to work with is, I think, quite very unstructured. Even I would connect to academia. Now, as an academic, if you want to go and conduct a study, you are not very easily allowed to some of these refugee displaced population, not that very easily granted. I think we need to, slowly sort it out and ensure that we will have better data, better research, better understanding, and of course, then better policies and practices will automatically.
Right, so that's actually very rightly put. That brings me to my next question, that what you've dealt with so properly is how we deal with challenges at the policy level. But here, if you look at another angle of it, as a peace builder, as a peacemaker, you're not only dealing with refugees and the parties and stakeholders that are necessary to them, but also the new society probably that they are moving into. Sometimes migrants, when they are moving into newer societies, the acceptance even in those societies becomes very difficult. How do you see it as a peacemaker, sir?
Well, it is true, again, nobody in the first place wants to be a refugee or a forced migrant. It's all forced upon them. It's beyond the control. They come to another country, another place, and explore how do they safeguard their lives and survive. So in that context, because of the lack of laws and legal framework, obviously it is very, very tough for them to come. And it varies from, refugee groups from one to another. For example, if Sri Lankans, if you take as an example, because of the language, cultural similarities between the Tamils in India and the Sri Lankan Tamils, you had more or less an acclimatization and acculturation in a way, and then that was a different comfort zone they have had. Right. Whereas if you talk about Rohingyas coming into India now, they do not have that very easy acceptance, and there is a lot of hostility, especially towards them, for whatever reasons. And therefore, then they live a very precarious, tough life. You may look at Chakmas or Chin refugees. They again have a very different kind of a scenario. Tibets, of course, had a good hospitality from the very beginning since the 1950s. Mm-hmm. And therefore, they are able to manage a very peaceful life with a lot of self-sufficiency and a lot of self-dependency. So they manage mm-hmm. quite well. So in a way, if you have to put in perspective about groups, refugees, displaced coming into a country mm-hmm. or mm-hmm. any other mm-hmm. part of South Asia, I think it's quite very difficult because mm-hmm. there are no clear laws, policies, which enables them, which facilitates them, which protects them, which provides them the basic needs. I think that is a very big gap. The second, as I told you earlier, about NGOs, civil society, academia, humanitarian professionals wanting to work again are not having full access. That makes it very difficult. So therefore, you know, even if you look at the example of Rohingyas living in let's say Cox's Bazar in Bangladesh. A lot of international agencies are, of course, there and providing support and other things. Right. But, you know, still their life is very tough. As we can look at the Rohingyas' life in Bangladesh, is not that very easy. Right. And they undergo a lot of suffering, as we see. And then we are even hearing about certain out-migrations happening. They are trying to flee to other places and all that. Why?
So if I can interrupt you here, my only question again goes back to the same thing, that while we are looking at a lack of legal frameworks and policy here, the main question here that bothers everybody is that dilemma about national security and humanitarian laws. How do you as a peacemaker would like to answer to that question on a policy level?
Definitely, you know, every nation has to take care of its national interest, national security, no doubt about it. But we also need to take care of the international obligations we have, international human rights obligations we have as the nation states throughout the world. I think rightfully called by Indian judiciary that we need to bring in a fine balance between humanitarianism and human rights and national security, national interest. There's no doubt about it. The point is that we are so much focusing on national security at times that we even try to miss out on the basic humanitarian help and aid which we could have extended. That is the important gap which I see. I think we need to extend that basic thing. What is the basic thing here underlines the humanitarianism? That somebody who is in a deep distress, deep pain, agony of persecution or conflict or whatsoever the reason, genuine reasons are there, what we call as a well-founded fear in the definition of 19th Convention, if you may apply, that the point is about saving their lives, that giving them a temporary shelter, saving their lives. You don't have to permanently give them citizenship to every person who's entering the country. The point is about having a framework to address their humanitarian needs, protect them and dutifully return them. Even if I take quickly the Sri Lankan Tamil example, if you look at the numbers, it's almost 4.5 lakh people have come at different points of time since entry till 2005 or 6. And then if you see, more than 3.5 have invariably either returned or gone to other countries. What we have is a small residue population of 80,000-90,000 people with whom we are as advisory committee today working to see how we can explore the durable solution. So if you look at the numbers, it's not that all these 4.5 lakh people have come in and said we want to be here permanently. Not so. I don't think that is the way we should look at anything as a threat to the nation. But definitely, if you document them, give them the basic support, and you can always as well monitor for the national security reasons, how are they living, what are they doing. If you don't count them, don't try to take care of them, rehabilitate them, give them relief, then you don't know what they are doing. Then it ends up giving us a surprise that it can be something very untoward in certain
situations. Right. So from what I can take from you is that that's a very interesting thing that you've mentioned, that you know, it's actually better to put them in, facilitate their process, because if we don't do that, it could be actually then turning into a national security threat.
Absolutely. I think just a closing remark, two or three frameworks I want to quickly highlight. I think what is happening today is that a lot of, focus is on the, consequence. But I think we are not focusing much on prevention of conflicts and, our endeavors globally. I'm saying that we are not addressing it, and then we are only trying to pay the price in terms of response. I think we need to shift from response-centric approach to more of preparedness, mitigation, and prevention strategies to prevent conflicts and human rights violations. That's very important. As our Indian Prime Minister keeps calling, this is not the age for warfare. I think that's very important. It's peace and development needed, number one. Number two, I think whatsoever beyond control, if there are conflicts, there are displacements which are anyway happening, getting accounted today at the global level as well as in our region, I think it's better that we have a better laws and better policies to address these things, because after all, India is today emerging as a big leader at the national level, not only in the Asian level, at the national, international level.
Right.
The way we have demonstrated G20, the way we have done inclusion of African Union, these are all great things which we are doing, as quoted that it's really a big deal. Therefore, it's also a big deal or relevant that we also try to bring in international human rights and humanitarian obligations. That's something, number two, we need to do. At the third level, as we are doing well economically, as we are trying to do an outreach, as we are trying to connect with the world, I think it's very important that we also play our important humanitarian role, which we are already doing very well, whether it's climate, natural disasters, conflicts, any crisis, we have always responded. I think we need to have better outreach and better humanitarian professionals who are produced to handle things within the country as well as outside the country. I think we need to do that outreach. So better research, for the last point, fourth point, better research, better data, better policies, all have to be tuned. Therefore, it will contribute to us as a nation in the transformation.
Thanks. I mean, I think that was the most comprehensive explanation our listeners could hear when it comes to the dilemma that constantly we face regarding how the issue of migration should really be addressed. I would like to close this discussion by quoting you only, sir, where you say that whichever country of origin they might be from, need for humanitarian diplomacy is very important. And I think that was a very, very insightful conversation that we had. I thank you for joining us today, sir, squeezing in time from your busy schedule. Any last remarks that you would like to give to our listeners in this direction?
I'm conversing to you. My best wishes to the Indian Conflict Resolution Podcast and the entire team. Thank you again for inviting me. It was a pleasure talking to you, Mr. Tejeshwar.
Thank you so much, sir.